De la revolución del mundo.
Justice by any means necessary.
This program is brought to you by Haymarket Books as part of the Socialism 2023 program. You can hear more recordings from the conference by subscribing to the Socialism Conference podcast feed. Many video recordings are also available at socialismconference.org. If you enjoy these recordings, you should join us for Socialism 2024, which will be held in Chicago next Labor Day weekend, August 30th through September 2nd. It's never too early to make a plan with your organization and your friends to come to the Socialism Conference.
My name is Kirsten Roberts. I'm a preschool teacher in the Chicago Public Schools. Yes, preschool. Early childhood education is a passion of mine. I began teaching in 2011 in the Chicago Public Schools, and my second year of teaching, I found myself on a picket line in the Chicago Teachers Union strike of 2012. I've been a socialist and an activist and a student of the labor movement since I was 15 years old, and I found myself at 40 years old on my first strike. And I learned more in those, how many days were we out? Seven?
7 days
of striking. I learned, I think, more about the capacity and power of ordinary people to change the world than I had in the previous decades of book study. Although that book study was really good, too. And you know, read books. I'm a teacher. Read books. So I'm excited for this discussion. I am still in the classroom, a rank and file teacher, but I also serve on the executive board of the Chicago Teachers Union. And I'm here to chair this meeting and to introduce Jesse Sharkey. Jesse Sharkey was a classroom teacher, a high school teacher, who taught in Rhode Island, then moved to Chicago, and very promptly found himself embroiled in a struggle to stop the turnaround of his school into a naval academy. He helped to found the Caucus of Rank and File Educators, which in 2010 won the election and began to serve as the leadership of the Chicago Teachers Union. Jesse served as the vice president of our union under the indomitable Karen Lewis, rest in power. And he later served as president of the Chicago Teachers Union and helped lead a really historic strike in 2019, as well as the job actions, strikes, during COVID to protect our students, our communities, and ourselves from the ravages of that horrible pandemic. Jesse stepped aside from union leadership last year to come back into the classroom, which is a sort of unheard of thing in the labor movement that a leading union official would come back into the rank and file ranks and also make room for new leadership, black women leadership in our union. And he is now writing a book about some of his experiences. And so I think this is going to be an interesting discussion. And we'll talk more about how your part of the conversation is going to go after Jesse is done presenting. Thank you so much.
Hey, everyone. Good afternoon. Hope you guys are having a great conference. It's good to see you. I should probably say that if people come in, maybe we should, if folks want to make sure there's places, near aisles or whatever, come swoosh in. There's room up front. Make a little bit of room so that when people come in late, when the tardy kids to class get here, that we can accommodate them. I also want to say that this is, I see a number of folks in the, here in the CTU. Kirsten, of course, we'll be grateful to have Kirsten as chair in this session. Kirsten's an important rank and file leader in this union who's been involved in really strategic discussions about most of the big decision points that we've made over the last more than a decade, and will be a valuable resource in our discussion. It's not going to be a talk about what's next for the CTU. It's going to be a talk about what's next in Chicago, and in the Chicago movements in particular, in the context of Brandon Johnson, who is a middle school teacher, member of the CTU, and then a CTU organizer, having been elected mayor last spring. Yeah, that's an applause line. That's a remarkable thing. And what I hope to do is sort of in the first part, split the talk into two parts, and really in the first part, bigger questions. Why do we contest the mayor's office? What are the potential dangers and benefits of that decision to do that? What does it mean for our movement to have one of our own in office? And then how should we evaluate the success or failure of this project? Electoral office is a dangerous place to be in a lot of ways. You don't look at elected office in the U.S. and think, bourgeois politics. That's really where we should be sending some of our best movement activists. So we're going to talk. I want to talk about that, especially in the first part. And then hopefully we get a little discussion going. And then if I can, there's a series of more detailed questions about sort of how will Brandon withstand the pressures of office, how we build our movement to take advantage of new horizons, particularly in view of some of the particular campaigns that we think are developing in the city of Chicago, and how will we then win our demands for housing, education, reforming the racist and justice system, and a series of other questions that come out of that. So I was kind of hoping to split it in parts and then hopefully get, the goal here would be to have some thoughtful and generative discussion and spend some time listening to each other and digging in. I think that we don't, as a left-wing movement, as a longtime socialist and an activist, you don't look around and say, oh, there's a lot of experience in the left about leading mass organization and leading struggle. We don't have a lot of that experience. The Chicago Teachers Union is one place where we do have a lot of that experience. And, it's important to say that, our union was in a lot of ways a backwater and was getting the snot kicked out of it for a long period of time. And it's a union that hadn't struck in 25 years. It was a victim of a whole bunch of nasty education reforms. I'll say a little bit more about that. And the key to the union kind of, turning, first of all, transforming its own internal political culture, winning an election, and then leading some struggles that sort of lit the fuse on the teacher strike wave in this country and sent Arne Duncan packing and the rest of it. Yeah. The key to that was a caucus in which many of the, it should be said, the key people were conscious socialists, leftists, who were able, came from different traditions and were able to figure out how to, put our ideological differences aside to work on a shared project, which was rebuilding labor militancy. And I just think it's useful to keep that in mind at the outset. So that's sort of the plan. Are there questions about that?
No.
Seem good? Okay. So in this first part, I really shouldn't go for much more than, I don't know, can you give me a warning at 10 and I'll try to not go longer than 13 minutes or something? Brandon Johnson, he was elected on April 10th of this year. His trajectory from middle school teacher and then a Chicago Teachers Union organizer, which is a newly created department in our union, to the mayor's office, I think mirrors the CTU's transformation from an isolated conservative union that, as I said, was really a punching bag in the city, into a social justice union that was bolstered by a burgeoning set of social movements in the city of Chicago. And it was a union that became unafraid to demonstrate, strike, and really ultimately set an agenda for the entire city. And I think we probably should see Brandon's election as a reflection of the importance of our grassroots work, a sign of the popular influence of our movement, and successful organizing more than just a signal that we can breathe easy now that we've got a guy in high office who will somehow overcome all the financial, political, and structural difficulties of living in a sort of a late capitalist society and make everything better for us. That's not the relationship the lessons that we want to take out of Brandon's election. Some of my comrades in Chicago have taken to saying that we've, quote, seized municipal power in Chicago. And I really want to push back on this formulation in as good-natured of a way as I can, but also as firm a way as I can. In my opinion, that expression, I don't see Jackson Potter here. This is he's the union's current vice president, really important person in our movement, likes to use this formulation. I've told him I don't agree with it. But I think that expression fails to get the key dynamic in our current situation. And in fact, it obscures the key dynamic. And I prefer to say a member of our movement has won the office of mayor. Now, there are some powers to that office. The mayor gets to appoint heads of municipal departments, like water and streets and sanitation and whatnot. The mayor's office prepares a budget, presides over the city council. It's a heck of a bully pulpit in a city like Chicago. But that's not really the only place where power resides in a capitalist society, is it? There's the power of money, the banks. The commodities exchanges, the real estate interests, industry broadly in Chicago. I read somewhere that Chicago, if just the city was a GMP, it would be the 21st largest gross national product in the world. So you get a sense of, this is a big global city that has, capital, it has real weight and power. They continue to control the purse strings of our society, and that's certainly true here. And last I checked, they weren't handing out billion-dollar checks because we won the office. The power of bureaucratic and technocratic inertia really needs to loom large as well. Chicago is a massive bureaucracy, about 30,000 city workers. All those city workers stay in place. I mean, like literally virtually all. I mean, I think maybe there's been something on the order of 100 people who've turned over with a new administration. And, encompassing millions of pages of rules about how things run and procedures and I don't think we can talk about seizing municipal power if every single part of how the city operates, from the way the transport operates to the way the water is delivered to the schools, the policing system, etc., hasn't changed at all. I mean, if we seize power just in order to continue to run things the same way we've been doing it, we fucked up. But I don't think that's why. I think what it is that there's the weight of money, the weight of bureaucratic inertia, the weight of capitalist common sense and ruling ideas. All these things constrain what a mayor can do, not to mention the fact that big changes have to be voted through city council. So in what meaningful way, then, have we seized power? I would argue that we should stop talking about it in that sense. When we have the ability to redistribute the second houses of wealthy people and give them to the unhoused, then that's when we've seized power. We're going to have to get a lot more power in a lot of arenas before we can truly make a deep transformation of what our society looks like. Now, I think that few in Chicago's activist community expect the city to meet all the demands of a decade's worth of social movements, or at least not right away. The price tag goes into the billions of dollars. We're talking about, demands around housing, jobs, restorative justice. We can make a long list there. The price tag for our schools alone is in the billions of dollars. And what are the benefits then of having an organizer elected as mayor? If I'm saying that there's this huge reserve of institutional power which is going to resist change, well, I think to me it really falls along three lines. The first is that the election raised expectations among working class Chicagoans and people of color in particular. There's a series of campaign promises. Brandon ran on a stump speech where he said, "This is a rich city. And we can, there's no reason why I can't provide for everybody." And some version of that was like the basic stump speech that he gave again and again. And, you know, the hopefulness there is that it helps people break out of a cynical idea that you can't change anything in the city. And that no matter what happens politically, it just reproduces the same old thing. And one thing I can tell you with a high degree of certainty is that consciously raising expectations about what we can achieve through struggle has been sort of a key in Chicago Teachers Union contract campaigns. And that you don't get the CTU going on strike in 12 or again for a day around political demands in 16 or 19 or the various charter strikes or the strike that Kirsten mentioned around COVID safety. If you don't have a union talking about full staffing in our schools, which we still don't have. If you don't have a union talking about we need a trained librarian in every school, which we still don't have. If you don't have a union talking about, you know, green jobs and green school facilities, which we still don't have. If you don't have a union talking about immigrant rights, ICE should be, you know, there shouldn't be ICE coming into our buildings. We should have housing for all of our students, etc. None of these are demands that we've won, really. I mean, in part, we've won some things towards them. But the point is that raising high demands does help produce struggle. We in 2012, we demanded a 28% raise, which was a little immodest, but we didn't get it. But like again, I think it's important that we raise things like that. And so that's the first thing about Brandon. The second is that with Brandon in office, space opens up for us to win people to our ideas. As there's going to be a series of policy proposals that are coming out of the mayor's office and are also being moved by the progressive aldermen in Chicago, and there's a progressive caucus among alders that I think has 14 members. Maybe I got that number wrong. Maybe it's 16. And it will mean that there will be debates about housing. So, for example, they'll be moving in city council this month and then be voted on next month, a proposal which would generate a 3% tax on all real estate transfers over $1.5 million. So if you sell your $100 million building, $3 million has to go to a fund which is going to be set up to combat and to help house, to combat homelessness and help the unhoused. Now, they think it's going to generate $100 million a year.
$160.
Is that right? Okay. Now, even $160 million will not solve the problem of homelessness in a city the size of Chicago. There's 68,000 unhoused people in Chicago last year. That was the number. So, you know, it's really solving that problem in earnest is going to require much more the kind of structural transformation I was talking about. But the ordinance once passed will then produce a referendum which people have to vote on to approve the tax. And the debate about that referendum will be a really important opportunity for activists to go out into neighborhoods in which we don't have to just talk about. I mean, the way the debate is going to be phrased in terms of bourgeois politics is going to be very, very narrow, right? It's going to be, oh, well, is it going to hurt the real estate market versus what are the actual things that you can buy for $160 million and people are going to want to look at, I don't know, like, what is this development going to cost and what are the utility bills on it going to be and where's it going to go? And there'll be NIMBYism and there's going to be all kinds of problems with the way that debate is staged in mainstream politics. But that doesn't have to constrain the left about the way we talk about it. We can ask the question, why are there vacant luxury hotels? Why, you know, why is there a 100 million square feet of empty office real estate downtown? What about people's second homes? What about all the people with Airbnbs, the speculative market in Airbnbs? Well, there's people who are on, what about controlling rent? What about social housing? What about the fact that the CHA has over $1 billion of unspent money for housing development? And there's going to be a lot of ways for the left to campaign on this issue that are going to be much more like, that are going to be class politics and are going to, so the fact that it's being moved officially puts it on TV, makes it a subject of lots of discussion, and then it produces an opportunity for us to talk politics with the people who, with the bases of our organizations and politicize people. I'm at 10?
Almost at 10 minutes.
Okay. Yeah. I'm getting towards the end here. And then, finally, I think all this is going to produce organizing opportunities, which is going to allow us to grow our unions, our neighborhood organizations, and our movements. So if we run campaigns that produce compelling narratives, that develop the thinking and ideas of our activists, and keep up the pressure through direct actions, then we can view the Johnson administration as a boon for our side. Not as the answer, not as someone that will produce manna from heaven, but as something that will help us organize. And I will. So just a couple things just to say before we get into a discussion, just to be clear. There is a definite danger that Brandon will make compromises with power and then use his credibility within the movement to tamp down dissent rather than encouraging the activism that made his rise possible. That's a definite danger. Likewise, there's a danger that we know that social movements can lose their way and devolve into electoral vehicles that demobilize as soon as the campaign is over. And in fact, there's already been some. I mean, we're a movement that spent the last decade plus campaigning against the mayor. And it's pretty much, it's been really easy unifying set of positions. We just go after who the mayor happens to be. And that's been very effective for us. And the fact that now the mayor comes out of our own movements means that we have to, the social movement organizations are needing to find their new footing. Some people went off from those organizations, left the leadership, and went off and worked for the mayor. So you go from like being in opposition to campaign mode to like actually being in relations with people who are in the city hall very quickly, and I don't think our organizations have found their footing yet. I have some confidence that they will, but you know, and the last thing I'll say here is that there is a reason why we contested the mayor's race. The CTU has had a series of fights which have raised broad social demands, or more accurately, the fact that we have tried to be in solidarity with social movements has meant that immigrant rights groups, housing advocates, prison abolitionists, people who are in favor of you know, against ecocide and in favor of a Green New Deal and whatnot, have all been a movement with us. And the CTU has adopted social movement demands to our credit. But what we found is that the collective bargaining process is an insufficient place to try to win those demands. So there's so the CTU moved into a political arena, I think, precisely because of the way social movement demands showed up inside of our inside of our unionism. And those things require social and political power to win. You know, we're fully aware there's a lot of difficulties and dangers in that electoral process. And yet, this is where we find ourselves with a lot of possibilities. And I would like to pause there and hopefully take a little bit of thoughtful discussion before going on and saying a few more things.
Thanks for listening. If you liked this episode, subscribe to our podcast and to the Haymarket Books YouTube channel, where events like this one are hosted live. And don't forget to check out haymarketbooks.org.